committed to peaceful coexistence. As for the hostages, I have a message for the Hamas captors. Let them go. Let them go. All of them. Those alive today must be returned alive. And the remains of those whom you brutally killed must be returned to their families. Those families here with us today and others in Israel deserve to have a resting place for their loved ones, a place where they can grieve and remember them. This war, ladies and gentlemen, this war can come to an end now. All that has to happen is for Hamas to surrender, lay down its arms, and release all the hostages. But if they don't, we will fight until we achieve victory, total victory. There is no substitute for it. Israel must also defeat Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hezbollah is the quintessential terror organization in the world today. It has tentacles that span in all continents. It has murdered more Americans and more Frenchmen than any group except bin Laden. It's murdered the citizens of many countries represented in this room. And it has attacked Israel viciously over the last 20 years, in the last year, completely unprovoked. A day after Hamas massacre on October 7th, Hezbollah began attacks against Israel, which forced more than 60,000 Israelis on our northern border to leave their homes, becoming refugees in their own land. Hezbollah turned vibrant towns in the north of Israel into ghost towns. So I want you to think about this in equivalent American terms. Just imagine if terrorists turned El Paso and San Diego into ghost towns. Then ask yourself, how long would the American government tolerate that? A day? A week? A month? I doubt they tolerated even for a single day. Yet Israel has been tolerating this intolerable situation for nearly a year. Well, I've come here today to say, enough is enough. We won't rest until our citizens can return safely to their homes. We will not accept a terror army perched on our northern border, able to perpetrate another October 7th-style massacre. For 18 years, Hezbollah brazenly refused to implement UN Security Council Resolution 1701, which requires it to move its forces away from our borders. Instead, Hezbollah moved right up to our border. They secretly dug terror tunnels to infiltrate our communities and indiscriminately fired thousands of rockets into our towns and villages. They fire these rockets and missiles not from military sites. Not from that. They do that too. But they fire those rockets and missiles after they place them in schools, in hospitals, in apartment buildings, and in the private homes of the citizens of Lebanon. They endanger their own people. They put a missile in every kitchen, a rocket in every garage. I said to the people of Lebanon this week, get out of the death trap that Hezbollah has put you in. Don't let Nasrallah drag Lebanon into the abyss. We're not at war with you. We're at war with Hezbollah, which has hijacked your country and threatens to destroy ours. As long as Hezbollah chooses the path of war, Israel has no choice and Israel has every right to remove this threat and return our citizens to their homes safely. And that's exactly what we're doing. Just this week, the IDF destroyed large percentages of Hezbollah's rockets, which had built with Iran's funding for three decades. We took out senior military commanders who not only shed Israeli blood, but American and French blood as well. And then we took out their replacements, and then the replacements of their replacements. and will continue degrading Hezbollah until all our objectives are met. Ladies and gentlemen, we're committed to removing the curse of terrorism that threatens all civilized societies. But to truly realize the blessing of a new Middle East, we must continue the path we paved with the Abraham Accords 4 years ago. Above all, this means achieving a historic peace agreement between Israel and Saudi Arabia. And having seen the blessings that we've already brought with the Abraham Accords, the millions of Israelis who've already flown back and forth across the Arabian Peninsula, over the skies of Saudi Arabia, to the Gulf countries, the trade, the tourism, the joint ventures, the peace. I say to you, what blessings such a peace with Saudi Arabia would bring. It would be a boon to the security and economy of our two countries. It would boost trade and tourism across the region. It would help transform the Middle East into a global juggernaut. Our two countries could cooperate on energy, water, agriculture, artificial intelligence, and many, many other fields. Such a peace, I'm sure, would be a true pivot of history. It would usher in a historic reconciliation between the Arab world and Israel, between Islam and Judaism, between Mecca and Jerusalem. While Israel is committed to achieving such a peace, Iran and its terror proxies are committed to scuttling it. That's why one of the best ways to foil Iran's nefarious designs is to achieve the peace. Such a peace would be the foundation for an even broader Abrahamic alliance. And that alliance would include the United States, Israel, current Arab peace partners, Saudi Arabia, and others who choose the blessing of peace. It would advance security and prosperity across the Middle East and bring enormous benefits to the rest of the world. With American support and leadership, I believe this vision can materialize, and much sooner than people think. And as the Prime Minister of Israel, I will do everything in my power to make it happen. This is an opportunity that we and the world should not let go by. Ladies and gentlemen, Israel has made its choice. We seek to move forward to a bright age of prosperity and peace. Iran and its proxies have also made their choice. They want to move back to a dark age of terror and war. And now I have a question. And I pose that question to you. What choice will you make? Will your nation stand with Israel? Will you stand with democracy and peace? Or will you stand with Iran, a brutal dictatorship that subjugates its own people, exports terrorism across the globe? In this battle between good and evil, there must be no equivocation. When you stand with Israel, you stand for your own values and your own interests. Yes, we're defending ourselves, but we're also defending you against a common enemy that through violence and terror seeks to destroy our way of life. So there should be no confusion about this. But unfortunately, there is a lot of it in many countries and in this very hall, as I've just heard. Good is portrayed as evil, and evil is portrayed as good. We see this moral confusion when Israel is falsely accused of genocide, when we defend ourselves against enemies who try to commit genocide against us. We see this too when Israel is absurdly accused by the ICC prosecutor of deliberately starving Palestinians in Gaza. What an absurdity. We helped bring in 700,000 tons of food into Gaza. That's more than 3,000 calories a day for every man, woman, and child in Gaza. We see this moral confusion when Israel is falsely accused of deliberately targeting civilians. We don't want to see a single person, a single innocent person die. That's always a tragedy. And that's why we do so much to minimize civilian casualties, even as our enemies use civilians as human shields. And no army has done what Israel is doing to minimize civilian casualties. We drop flyers. We send text messages. We make phone calls by the millions to ensure that Palestinian civilians get out of harm's way. We spare no effort in this noble pursuit. We see yet another profound moral confusion when self-described progressives march against the democracy of Israel. Don't they realize they support the Iranian-backed goons in Tehran and in Gaza? The goons who gun down protesters, murder women for not covering their hair, and hang gays in public squares, some progressives. According to the U.S. Director of National Intelligence, Iran funds and fuels many of the protesters against Israel. Who knows, maybe some of the protesters, or even many of the protesters, outside this building now. Ladies and gentlemen, King Solomon, who reigned in our eternal capital, Jerusalem, 3,000 years ago, proclaimed. He proclaimed something that is familiar to all of you. He said, "There is nothing new under the sun." Well, in an age of space travel, quantum physics, and artificial intelligence, some would argue that's a debatable statement. But one thing is undeniable. There is definitely nothing new at the United Nations. Take it from me. I first spoke from this podium as Israel's ambassador to the UN in 1984. That's exactly 40 years ago. And in my maiden speech here, I think it's the same podium, by the way. In my maiden speech here, I spoke against a proposal to expel Israel from this body. 4 decades later, I find myself defending Israel against that same preposterous proposal. And who's leading the charge this time? Not Hamas, but Abbas, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. This is the man who claims he wants peace with Israel. Yet he still refuses to condemn the horrific massacre of October 7th. He's still paying hundreds of millions to terrorists who murder Israelis and Americans. It's called pay for slay. The more you murder, the more you get paid. And he still wages unremitting diplomatic warfare against Israel's right to exist and against Israel's right to defend itself. And by the way, they amount to the same thing. Because if you can't defend yourself, you can't exist. Not in our neighborhood, certainly, and maybe not in yours. Standing in this podium 40 years ago, I told the sponsors of that outrageous resolution to expel Israel, "Gentlemen, check your fanaticism at the door." Today, I tell President Abbas and all of you who would shamefully support that resolution, check your fanaticism at the door. The singling out of the one and only Jewish state continues to be a moral stain on the United Nations. It has made this once respected institution contemptible in the eyes of decent people everywhere. But for the Palestinians, this UN house of darkness is home court. They know that in this swamp of anti-Semitic bile, there's an automatic majority willing to demonize the Jewish state on anything. In this anti-Israel, flat-earth society, any false charge, any outlandish allegation can muster a majority. In the last decade, there have been more resolutions passed against Israel in this hall at the UN General Assembly than against the entire world combined. Actually, more than twice as many. Since 2014, this body condemned Israel 174 times. It condemned all the other countries in the world 73 times. That's more than 100 extra condemnations for the Jewish state. What hypocrisy. What a double standard. What a joke. So the UN's hostility. So all the speeches you heard today, all the hostility directed at Israel this year, it's not about Gaza. It's about Israel. It's always been about Israel, about Israel's very existence. And I say to you, until Israel, until the Jewish state is treated like other nations, until this anti-Semitic swamp is drained, the UN will be viewed by fair-minded people everywhere as nothing more than a contemptuous farce. Now, given the anti-Semitism at the UN, it should surprise no one that the prosecutor at the ICC, one of the UN's affiliated organs, is considering issuing arrest warrants against me and Israel's defense minister, the democratically elected leaders of the Democratic State of Israel. The ICC prosecutor's rush to judgment, his refusal to treat Israel with its independent courts the way other democracies are treated, is hard to explain by anything other than pure anti-Semitism. Ladies and gentlemen, the real war criminals are not in Israel. They're in Iran. They're in Gaza, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen. Those of you who stand with these war criminals, those of you who stand with evil against good, with a curse against the blessing, those of you who do so should be ashamed of yourselves. But I have a message for you. Israel will win this battle. We'll win this battle because we don't have a choice. After generations in which our people were slaughtered, remorselessly butchered, and no one raised a finger in our defense, we now have a state. We now have a brave army, an army of incomparable courage, and we are defending ourselves. As the book of Samuel says in the Bible, Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker, the eternity of Israel will not falter. In the Jewish people's epic journey from antiquity, in our odyssey through the tempests and upheavals of modern times, that ancient promise has always been kept, and it will hold true for all time. To borrow a great poet's phrase, Israel will not go gently into that good night. We will never need to rage against the dying of the light, because the torch of Israel will forever shine bright. To the people of Israel and to the soldiers of Israel, I say, be strong and of good courage. Chizku v'imtzu ve'al tirau mipnehem, ki Adonai Elohecha, hu ha'olech imecha, lo yarapecha ve'lo yazvecha. Am Yisrael Chai, the people of Israel live now, tomorrow, forever. Thank you.
Benjamin Netanyahu there, the Israeli Prime Minister addressing the UN General Assembly. Well, obviously this meeting has been going on for 3 days now. Keir Starmer spoke there last night. In case you missed it yesterday, we brought some of it on the show yesterday, actually. This is some of the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas speaking at the UN yesterday via a translator.
I salute our heroic people that are... sacrificing all that is precious for Palestine in the Gaza of sacrifice, in the West Bank of solidarity of Al-Quds, which is our crown jewel and our capital. We salute our people in the diaspora, in the camp, in the refugee camps, to our brave prisoners in Israeli prisons, 6,000 prisoners. Israel arrests whoever it wants. Those prisoners whose dignity is being violated every day. Palestine will be free. despite anyone who objects to that. Our people will live on the land of their fathers and grandfathers as they have done for more than 6,000 years. They will continue their legitimate struggle for independence. The occupation will end, will end, will end. God and peace, blessings be upon you.
That was a clip of Mahmoud Abbas at the UN General Assembly yesterday, just following up after we brought you Benjamin Netanyahu addressing the UN today, vowing to pursue total victory. Was saying, if you strike Israel, we will strike you. And making clear he was intent on pursuing victory. More on that throughout the day here on 5 Live, no doubt on Drive from 4 o'clock today. Let's go back to the other breaking news we've had since on the last hour or so. The death of Dame Maggie Smith at the age of 89. Best known for her roles in Harry Potter and, of course, Downton Abbey.
You're a woman with a brain and reasonable ability. Stop whining and find something to do.
Well, of course, her Downton counterpart, Hugh Bonneville, one of her most famous co-stars, he's paid his own tribute today, saying anyone who ever shared a scene with Maggie will attest to her sharp eye, sharp wit and formidable talent. She was a true legend of her generation and thankfully will live on in so many magnificent screen performances. My condolences to her boys and wider family. And Sir Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, has posted this on X. Keir Starmer saying Dame Maggie Smith introduced her to new worlds with the countless stories she acted over her long career. She was beloved by so many for her great talent, becoming a true national treasure whose work will be cherished for generations to come. Our thoughts with her family and loved ones. May she rest in peace. Well, let's speak now to Anna Smith, a film critic and the host of the Girls on Film podcast. Hi, Hannah.
Hello, how are you doing?
Am I good? Am I good? I'm sort of intrigued as to when you think of Maggie Smith, what's the first film, TV performance, play, whatever it might be, what's your go-to?
The one that I think of is the one I actually watched the most recently, and that is A Room with a View. Just a magnificent period drama, which I grew up watching, and she plays a chaperone on a holiday. Beautiful, beautiful film, and it's such a sharp, funny script. And my goodness, not a comedic line is wasted in Maggie Smith's mouth. I mean, she really, and as we just heard, is a wonderful dramatic actress, but she was also so good at comedy and those famous put-downs, which, of course, she put to great use in the likes of Downton Abbey.
At Downton Abbey. I was just thought when it was one of those things when the news came through, I thought, well, I'm, you know, going to talk around the breaking news. You know, go to Wikipedia or IMDb and you start looking. But there were just so many. It's like a forest of huge films that you have to pick your way through. And you suddenly thought, oh, God, she was in Sister Act. There were some people just being in Sister Act alone would be enough. You know, The Secret Garden, The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, The Lady in the Van. And she was someone who, you know, in many ways got better with age. And by the time she's playing the Dowager Duchess in Downton Abbey, she's just absolutely at her peak.
She was. She was utterly confident in her roles then. And I think it took a while. She was, you know, very popular in theatre for a while, and it took a while for the film industry to notice and for those kind of roles to come her way. But as you say, I think in a way she's one of those actors that grew into herself as she became older. And she, that sort of gravitas that she had just increased. And she could just own a room. She could own the screen. And in all those films, however small or big the roles were, she just stole the show completely.
Oh, thanks for that, Anna. Really good to get those your reflections on the death of Dame Maggie Smith at the age of 89. And I'm sure there will be more reaction throughout the day here on 5 Live on Drive as well. Now, though, the show is a very fluid show. It's a very fluid show today. Lots of you getting in touch, which is nice. But I'm now thrilled to be joined by one of the great political commentators of our time.
I'm actually very right-wing, and I loved it.
And whatever happens, so you come back. Well, I was going to say, going
I love it.
Well done, Liz.
When I was a little girl, I used to run through the fields of wheat, and the farmer wasn't too happy about that.
It's sort of like the backwash of the available MPs. Well, it was nice to hear from Rishi Sunak. He's not going to be Prime Minister, so you may as well have interviewed Peter Andre.
To the Right Honourable Lisa Nandy MP.
Is that a bit formal?
All right, Bab. I now have to direct my delightful whinging towards their Labour successors.
How do you like it? How do you like it?
And here he is.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm very good.
So nice to see you. Got you on Five Live, the new Richard Bacon.
Well, that's very kind.
Yes.
I wouldn't dream of saying such a thing. But it's
well,
like,
I've said it.
You've said it, and you've
so
said it now.
There you go.
On Five Live. You're almost wearing Five Live colours. A little green.
Almost, yes.
Yeah, yes. Sort of disappearing into the logo behind
yes,
it.
Yes, well, you know, I knew I was coming on. And
you were coming on the radio, so you thought you'd dress
I
up.
I thought I'd dress up as the Five Live, not the logo, but the background
vibes
of the screen that you have. There are a lot of screens in this studio.
I know.
Do you need all of them?
It's for company, really, because most of the time I'm sitting on my own.
Yes. Yeah, but I mean, these are ridiculous. For the benefit of the listeners, I would say these screens are the size of basically a human, like a small...
yeah, they are taller,
not even a small, like a kind of average-sized woman would be the size of that screen, I would say. Like a sort of, small car.
Yeah. It's for the,
there's two of them.
It's for all the social media videos they take and then
yes.
don't put out. Yeah. Anyway, you might do...
Sorry, I'm just taking the studio and I imagine you wanted to talk to me about other things.
Well, you could have been flicking the Hoover man. How are you adjusting to, you know, as a very right-wing political commentator, this
yes.
new political...
Gosh, it's difficult, isn't it? You know, yeah. being on the back foot now with this very progressive, forward-thinking government changing everything. I'm good, yes, I'm... I don't know how to sort of respond to... Someone asked me... I was with some Americans earlier in the week from Birmingham. The Birmingham...
Yes, because you've been to all the Birminghams.
And they were asking me about politics here, and I was sort of saying that it's nice to have a grown-up in charge, but I don't really know... You know, a friend of mine said to me last week, you know, to me... doesn't really, I don't feel any difference between a Labour, like the Tories may as well still be in power. I don't know whether that's going to be true. Long
it's early days. As
it's
they
so
say.
Early days, but I don't, yeah. I don't know how long it takes you to change, sort of unravel what's happened. It probably takes you a few months, years, a couple of terms, I don't know.
He is at least, though, Keir Starmer, addressing the big issues.
The return of the sausages.
Did you enjoy that this week?
I mean, it's one of the great. I mean, it won't leave
the return of the sausages.
It was a real mistake giving me that on the butt.
He corrected himself.
Yeah,
because then everyone knows exactly what he was going for. Yeah, I don't feel for him. I think it's very funny. Really. It was a very funny thing.
The return of the sausages.
Now, you're actually here, not to provide political commentary, although that's nice.
Yeah, well, I mean, nobody cares what I think.
You've written a book.
Yes, it's not very political. I say that, actually. Liz
Well,
Truss
hang on, Liz Truss isn't
and
here.
Priti Patel.
And Therese Coffey.
And Therese Coffey. So the painting I did of Therese Coffey, I loved this.
Yeah.
So all the it's a for the benefit of the listeners, it's a book of paintings and then writing about those paintings. The writing is total nonsense.
So, but it looks, if you were a foreigner...
Yes.
And you went into a bookshop and you picked it up. You'd think it was an art book, like a proper art.
Well, it
looks like an art book. It's got lots of pictures. And then next to it, lots of sort of artsy-fartsy like footnotes and things. So the layout is like a proper high-end intellectual art.
An artist's monograph is what you would call
it. And then you look at it more closely.
Any of the words.
And there's Timothy Chalamet Mallet. So it's a...
That's merger, a portrait of Timothy Chalamet merged with Timmy Mallet.
Yeah.
Timothy Chalamet Mallet, yeah.
Yeah. And then, actually, there's lots of words in here that I can't remember.
Oh, most of it's unbroadcastable. But the paintings had to be sent to this scanner, this sort of high-res scanner, in order to get them good quality for the book. And the Therese Coffey painting that I did, I didn't tell the scanner what the paintings were. I just sort of handed them over. The Therese Coffey one came back as smokingboy.jpg. So I'm not sure I got the likeness bang on. It's that famous... picture of her with a glass of champagne and the cigar, and the champagne spilt up her top, and I painted that, and I think the likeness is pretty good, but the scanner thought it was a smoking boy.
Do people you paint, because I mean, I certainly became aware, you know, I've known each other for a while, I probably became aware of you doing the painting with the Chris Whitty one.
Yes, so that was
during
lockdown. Well, that was kind of, I'd been painting for a while before that. I've been painting for about 10 years, but that one was the sort of most sort of, the one that got me into kind of going, oh, maybe I should show these publicly, because it was part of Grayson Perry's, Grayson's art club in lockdown. And people were very nice about that painting. So, yeah, and then I've just kind of not stopped since. And I get so much from it. And what's been strange about it is that sometimes doing comedy and TV can be a bit of a slog now, because I've been doing it for so long and it's sort of, it's work. But doing painting hasn't become that, even though I'm now trying to monetize it. It's become, it's still really like
mindful, therapeutic
and mindful and all that. Do you draw? Do you paint?
I've done a bit of painting. I don't have the time. Yeah, I painted my mother-in-law's house once.
Oh.
No, as in, like, a picture. I don't mean, like,
yeah, I was going to
Magnolia on the walls. That's the entire separate thing. Well, listen, Joe, you're going to stay around for a bit?
Yes.
We came to a bit late. Joe Lyce is going to say, if you've got any questions for Joe, 85058 on the text.
Make them nice. Don't make them nice.
Somebody's texted in, said you haven't actually said it's Joe Lyce. Yeah, I'm aware of that. But look, it's been a busy show. Right, Joe Lyce will be back next, after we get a news update from Laura Harms.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The family of Dame Maggie Smith says she's died peacefully in hospital at the age of 89. A statement from her sons has described her as an extraordinary mother and grandmother. The Downton Abbey and Harry Potter actress won 2 Academy Awards, 5 BAFTAs and 4 Emmys in her career. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has praised what he's described as the incredible courage of Israeli soldiers while addressing world leaders at the UN General Assembly. Pressure is growing on him to agree to ceasefire deals with the Lebanese armed group Hezbollah as well as Hamas in Gaza. The family of 19-year-old Sean Cesarhigh, who was stabbed to death in Wolverhampton by 2 12-year-old boys, say his killer's sentences are too lenient. The pair, who are now 13, have been sentenced to life with a minimum term of 8.5 years for his murder. And 2 women have been jailed for a protest where they threw soup over Van Gogh's sunflowers. 23-year-old Phoebe Plummer and Anna Holland, who's 22, were activists for Just Stop Oil. That's the 5 Live News. Mike McCarthy has the sport.
And let's get the latest from Lourdes, where Australia put England into bat in a rain-reduced fourth one-day international. Ellie Aldroyd is there and there's been a wicket.
Yes, Phil Salt out at court at point by Smith off the bowling of Josh Hazlewood, who's bowled absolutely beautifully so far here at Lourdes. Out for 22, Phil Salt. England 48 for 1, Ben Duckett on 21, and the 2 openers taking a while to really get stuck in because of the quality of the bowling, particularly Hazlewood and Stark. But Australia have taken the first wicket to Will Jacks, joining Duckett in the middle. 39 overs aside, England 48 for 1 in the 10th.
Ellie, thank you. Commentary continues on 5 Sports Extra. Manchester City boss Pep Guardiola says his side will need to find a way to cope without influential midfielder Rodri. He's been ruled out for the rest of the season after knee surgery this morning. Guardiola says the Spaniard will be tough to replace.
What he gave us, we don't have a not a similar player, but the other players all together can replace what Rodri have given since arrived to us. So we have to do it as a team, and we have to find a way.
Says he will also be without Kevin De Bruyne for tomorrow's Premier League trip to Newcastle. Elsewhere, Arsenal goalkeeper David Raya remains a doubt from the Gunners' clash with Leicester at the Emirates. Liverpool should have goalkeeper Alisson back to face Wolves tomorrow, but their opponents have problems. Head coach Gary O'Neill's not quite sure who he'll have available.
Yeah, a little bit of a virus going around, so Dr. Kai has been busy this week trying to help the lads feel a little bit better, and quite a few missed training today. So, we'll see how we are tomorrow.
Meanwhile, the Scottish FA's new VAR manager, John Moss, has stepped down to take up a senior position with another national association. He'd been in the job for just 52 days. The Super League playoffs kick off tonight with the elimination weekend. Salford host Lee tonight after boss Paul Rowley led them to fourth place. Despite a modest budget, he's expecting the side to be well back tonight.
We're looking at a record crowd because the product's massive. We're probably the 2 teams that are surrounded by all the bigger clubs in Lancashire, but we're the 2 teams that are probably bat above our average. And as a result of that and the way both of us have played and performed and scrap, and we're both underdogs, then it's provided 2 teams that you probably don't know what you're going to get. It's a bit of a crackerjack draw, really, and it's exciting.
There's full commentary on the BBC Sport website this evening with the second half on 5 Live. And Swiss Cycling says our hearts are broken following the death of 18-year-old rider Muriel Ferrer. She died this morning in hospital after suffering a serious head injury at the Road and Paracycling World Championships in Switzerland yesterday. That's the latest from BBC Sport.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us. Matt Chorley. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Very good afternoon to you, Matt Chorley. With you for what, the next 26 minutes? 25 and a half minutes. Let's not too partridge about it. It's been a busy old show. Joe Lycett is still here talking about his book.
Hello.
Oh, hang on. I've not put your mic up.
Hello.
There we are.
Hello.
There we are. I'm here
simply to promote my book and nothing else. I'm not here to see you, Matt. I'm just here on a promotional tour. You've just asked me to sign the book. I'm guessing this is a free BBC copy that was put in your hands. Did you go down to a book?
Well, let's not get bogged down in that now.
Okay. Yeah. Well, just so how effervescent my signature is. You've given me this pen with a popular hotel.
Which, I came in this morning and thought, I haven't got a pen because I've got my wrong bag. And I was trying to find a pen anywhere in this building, in the whole of the BBC. And there's all I could find was that free pen from a mid-market hotel chain.
Yes, well, I'm just writing the word indignity. Is that a word?
I don't know. You're very dangerous of going off the page. Yeah. Kev from Stoke has been in touch saying, Mr. Lycett, what's your favourite sandwich? Mine is BLT with no mayo on brown bread. Some may say it's a little dry, but I just don't like mayo.
Gosh, the quality of questions on 5 Live's dropped, hasn't it? I love a club sandwich, you know. Club sandwich is very holiday to me. Club sandwich, yeah. Cider fries, big fan of a club sandwich, but also pretty much anything between two slices of bread, like, a cheese toasty, anything. Yeah, I'm now salivating.
Anything you don't like in a sandwich?
I'm not mad on mustardy things. I've got it really affects my sinuses having wasabi and that kind of thing. So there you go. What an insight!
Yeah,
there into my.
Well, yesterday we were taught. We had Graham Brady on the show yesterday, just to demonstrate the breadth of the
sport. A sport person?
No, former chairman of the 1922 committee. He was the one that people used to write the letters to and say, "I want."
Yes, Graham Brady. Right. Yes,
and he said that when Liz Truss was on her way out, he went into number 10 to tell her, you know, the game's up.
Yeah.
And he was in there for so long, he was in there for 2 hours, and the rolling news channels were all doing, Graham Brady's now been in there for 2 hours. It's obviously she's refusing to go.
Yes.
And now the party chairman's now joined us, and he's obviously had a tense standoff. Anyway, he said, he went in, said, I think you've got to go. She said, it's fine, I already know, but you can't leave, so you're going to have to stay. So they put him in a room watching the rolling news with a cup of tea and a tuna sandwich. For 2 hours.
That's strange.
While she wrote her speech saying she was off. So he wasn't, there was no tense standoff. He was just him on his own.
Like, she went, fine, just got to write
the tuna sandwich. Yeah.
Well, that's sort of disappointing, really. I would have liked to think that she was sort of screaming and wailing and kicking tables and whatever. But
you know when you did all that on the Laura Koonsberg show on the Sunday morning? You clapped and whooped and cheered.
Yes.
Have you ever come across Liz Truss since?
No, I would really like to. Someone asked me the other day if there's anyone I'd like to paint in real life, you know, have it sit for me. And I think Liz Truss would be fascinating. At points start to develop a sympathy for her, and then she says something, and then it all melts away. I think I'd be up for it. I'd be up for meeting her again. I think it's unlikely.
Well, she's coming to Birmingham.
She coming to next week?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll pop in.
Tory Party conference.
Oh, how lovely.
Bring your watercolours.
Where she's staying. Where does she stay?
Probably where that pen's from.
Under the canal somewhere. It wouldn't surprise me if she just jumps off Black Sabbath Bridge into the canal, and that's where she dwells for the night, and then emerges like some sort of lizard. Lizard Truss.
Lizard Truss. That's a good painter.
Yes, Lizard Truss.
So I'm going Monday.
I'm literally now want to paint that.
Yeah.
I like merging people with things, like watermelon sugar. I did Alan Sugar as a watermelon, watermelon sugar.
Yeah.
So Lizard Truss, why not?
I'm coming up to Birmingham Sunday.
Are you?
I'll be there Sunday, Monday, Tuesday.
So I saw someone who will remain nameless, a former BBC broadcaster, who said to me that they're getting old and that they worry that they're becoming more right-wing and more Tory. And they said the great antidote to that is going to a Tory party conference because there's no way that you want to be part of that gang once you've been there.
I think that's probably true of all party conferences.
Yes.
There was this element of when you're on the train or in the car on the way home, you just think, I don't know if I want to see another politician ever again.
No, yeah, it's not a thrill.
Let me go over and have a shower and wash it off. Where should I go in Birmingham? Because you've been to how many Birminghams have you been to?
I've been to 10, other than the Birmingham UK, I've been to 10 other Birminghams.
And they all in America?
All in America. There's one in Canada, and then we weren't including New Birminghams because there's a few New Birminghams. Apparently there's one in Jamaica, a New Birmingham in Jamaica, and there's a Birmingham on the moon. There's a crater called Birmingham. I've not been to that one either. But yes, I've been to 10 Birminghams. But Birmingham, UK, what are you looking for, like restaurants?
Well, I don't know. What's on your must-do list?
Well, I'm a big fan of...
Somebody's just shouted in my ear. Curries!
Oh, yes, you've got to have a Balti. Go to Shababs for a Balti.
Right, I'm going to ask you this. Where's that? Where's that?
Shababs is in the Balti, in the Balti Triangle.
There we are.
And then, I mean, there's an extraordinary array of restaurants. We put ourselves down so often, or we're put down by other people. We have more Michelin stars than anywhere outside of London. So
really?
More than Manchester, more than anywhere else.
Yeah.
And a really good culinary scene. So if you want... I mean, this is the thing we've got, you know, a Balti's not going to cost you a lot of money. There's an amazing restaurant called Santorini that will do an incredible halloumi wrap. And that's, you know, the price of a halloumi wrap, not a lot. But then you can go to like top end, you know, wine flights, all of that. And it's everything in between.
I'll have to check the BBC subsistence rules to see how far I can stretch.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
yes.
When you're out and about.
Okay. It might be a tuna sandwich then. Tuna sandwich from a Tesco. Why not? And then loads of galleries. There's lots of good places to go.
Art, yeah.
You know, Icon Gallery, Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery.
And you did your Channel 4 show from there.
I did my Channel 4 show from Digbeth, also a good place to have a look around.
Yeah,
there's a lot of good graffiti around there. There's a very nice pizza restaurant there called Baked in Brick.
This is all useful. I mean, all probably... You're just plugging all these places. As long as you don't own all of these places, because that'll get me into loads of trouble.
Like Stephen Bartlett all over again. I've got shares in all of them. No, I have no financial investment in any of the places I've mentioned, I don't think. I mean, I would know, wouldn't I?
You'd hope so. Unless it's one of those like...
I have an investment in Santorini.
Do you?
Because they have... It's a kind of a Greek or Cypriot restaurant doing kind of those sorts of delicious foods. And they have on the walls photographs of all the celebs that have been into the restaurant. And... For example, Steve McFadden, who plays Phil Mitchell in EastEnders, has been in a couple of times because he does Panto around the corner.
Yeah.
And he's on the wall under the name Phil McFadden. So they don't even care about getting the names right. And all the cast of the Hippodrome, Joe McKeldry.
I love a restaurant with a...
They're all there. Celebrity. And I go in loads. I talk about it loads because it is genuinely an amazing halloumi wrap. And every time I go in, they sort of look at me like I'm dirt on their shoe and never take a photograph. actually, that's wrong. They did do a photograph with me once and they asked what my name was. And I wrote down on a piece of paper, James Acaster. So they didn't put the photograph on.
Oh.
So I'm furious. So I'm not invested financially, but I'm invested spiritually in the Santorini restaurant because I want to be on the walls. But I want to be on the walls for the right reasons, because they are thrilled that a celebrity's there. But they've seen me so often now, they're just like, oh, it's that weird bloke.
I love a restaurant with a celebrity lineup.
Oh, my God. What a lineup. There's Claire Sweeney's on there. Because the Hippodrome Theatre is just around the corner, so all the Panto cast go in there. It's open till like 3 a.m. every night. I mean, what a...
This is just turns out. I must stress that other restaurants without photos of Joe Bassett are also available.
BBC endorsed Santorini.
Question for Joe, says James in London. What's Kylie Minogue like?
Oh, my God.
Did you meet her this morning?
I met her this morning on Radio 2. She is heaven. Oh, truly.
I thought you were going to say, she is hellish.
No, well, you kind of... I wasn't... You know, when you meet people like that, you don't know. Gosh, you know, I'm sure I've met some rotters. But she was truly... She was very funny and very warm and, yeah, really easy company. And I'm a fan anyway. So I was like, it was, I was,
you know, was she a fan of yours?
She did not know who I was.
Oh.
I'm fairly sure she didn't know who I was, but she was very open, but we're with everyone, you know, she was, I'm really not a convert because I liked her anyway, but yeah. I was really impressed with her.
Someone's just texting and said there's a restaurant on the moon, nice food, but it's got no atmosphere.
Thank you for your contact.
Thank you for that.
Very nice.
850-58 if you want to get in touch with any more of those. 08085-909-693. Joe Lycett Arts, Joe Lycett's Art Hole.
Yes.
It's out today, isn't it? Yesterday.
It was out yesterday.
It's a whopper. I mean, if you've got like an issue with mice or something, this is...
It's a brick. It's a real solid slab of a thing. Yes. Yes, it's... I'm really happy with it. I worked hard on it. And will you do me a solid and buy a copy?
Oh, I please. So you can afford another halloumi
wrap. Or don't buy one. Whatever you want to do. But it's, yeah, it was often with these things, you think, oh, it's not going to come out the way you wanted. You think, oh, you know, the print quality is not going to be great. It's actually better than I'd hoped. And yeah, very happy.
You ought to put that on the front. Better than I hoped. There we are.
Yes, better than I'd hoped. My standards were low. They were surpassed.
Joe, it's lovely to see you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And dressed like Five Live. What an absolute treat. On no other show do you go from Benjamin Netanyahu to Joe Lycett, but there we are. Lovely stuff. Right, now, what are we doing now? Are we doing this, aren't we? Hang on, here we go. Are we doing this? I jump queue, because I'm smarter than you. Oh, we're not doing this, are we? Well, we'll turn that off. Well, I don't know, maybe there is a queue of people who want to know about the new Scottish Tory leader. We're going to Scotland now. Journalist turned politician Russell Findlay was elected earlier after a ballot of party members of the new Scottish Tory leader, replacing Douglas Ross. Here's a bit of his victory speech.
I'm not a career politician. I understand your frustrations and your sense that nobody really represents the views that you share and hold. And that is going to change. Under my leadership, the Scottish Conservatives are going to change. We will work hard to earn your trust by doing things differently. We will be a voice for decent, mainstream Scotland and the values of hard work, self-reliance and value for taxpayers.
So let's get more of an insight from Scotland now with the Scottish political editor of PA Media. Katrine Boosie is on the line. Hi, Katrine.
Hello, how are you?
Very good. What do listeners need to know about Russell Findlay?
What do they need to know about Russell Findlay? He's probably going into one of the toughest jobs in Scottish politics at the moment. The Tories have been struggling in the Scottish Parliament. We saw them perform well in terms of MPs in the recent election, but not have a great result in terms of vote share. They held five of the six MPs that they have in the Westminster general election, which compared to the performance of the party as a whole seems impressive. And that comes after Douglas Ross quit as leader during the election campaign. So now Russell Findlay has come in, has been elected to take over and lead the party. And now he'll have to go about trying to unite the party after what's been quite a difficult and fractious leadership campaign.
And what was that? What was those fractures based on? Was it personality? Was it policy? Was it the approach that the Scottish Conservatives should take?
I think leadership campaigns can always be divisive for parties. You're always pitting parts of a party against another and supporters of one politician against supporters of a rival. In this leadership campaign, we've seen one of the contenders, Megan Gallagher, allege that senior figures in the Tory party had kind of been moving against her, saying that calls were made suggesting that she was going to be pulling out of the race. And there's an ongoing complaints process in relation to that. She claims her career's being threatened. So it has been quite a difficult campaign for the party, although Megan Gallagher was it turned out the weakest of the three candidates in the leadership contest, polling just over 400 votes, whereas Russell Findlay got over 2,500.
Katrine, thanks for that. A top briefing. Katrine Boosie there, the political editor of PA Media, on the news that the Scottish Conservatives have a new leader in the shape of Russell Findlay. Right, let's try one more time. Such a mistake giving me my own buttons. Here we are.
I jump queue, because I'm smarter than you.
Yes, we're talking the politics of every Friday, around this time. Time's a very flexible thing. We talk about the politics of something. We've previously done, what, the Tour de France. We did the politics of toilets. Today, we're talking about the politics of queuing. We're joined by Professor Tim Newburn, an academic from the London School of Economics, who's recently written a book called Orderly Britain, all about the ordinary organisations of a Britain's life. And there's quite a lot of queuing in it. Hi, Tim.
Good afternoon.
Great to have you with us. And Brett Little, it is the People Movement Lead at design company Arup. Hello, Brett.
Hi. Hi.
I don't know where to start, really, with this. Tim, the history of queuing and the idea that Britons are uniquely enthusiastic about doing it.
Yes, it's what we imagine about ourselves. So, I mean, people everywhere queue when there's too much of something, not enough to go around, some means of kind of distributing things. We get in a queue one way or another. Travel the world, you'll find people queue. The question really is why we think of ourselves as a nation of queues, and it really goes back to the Second World War, to, you know, the kind of the general shortages of food and other goods, and the fact that housewives in particular spent their lives queuing for stuff in that time. So it became very much associated with the sort of Blitz spirit, a source of British pride, and then subsequently kind of got turned on its head and was used by Churchill in the early 1950s as a stick to beat the aptly Labour government. Britain wasn't improving its lot nearly well enough. He described Britain as Q-topia rather than utopia.
And then we saw, I suppose, the Q, when I was thinking about doing this, the politics of the Q, the famous Conservative poster from 1978, the Labour isn't working, again with a queue. Actually, a queue they had to fake because not enough people turned up to the photo shoot. But the power in your mind, you're right, the interesting thing is that being in a queue, being a negative, to be weaponised politically.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's been used. It was used, as you say, famously initially by Churchill, then by the Thatcher opposition, then government. Labour isn't working, and then Labour still isn't working. It worked so well the first time, they used it again. I mean, none of us like to queue, but all of us have to queue. I mean, in modern times, then what's happened really is we're surrounded by a whole kind of variety of means of trying to make queuing seem a more pleasurable, kind of less burdensome activity.
So let's bring in Brett. So Brett, you design queues, you try to manage queues by modelling how different types of people might queue. Is that right?
Yeah, we look at all different types of space and how it's used, how people move through space, and queuing is obviously part of that. So we look at things like in a stadium, we'll look at how people get in and out, but we'll also look at halftime, how they might get a drink or some food, and how we can sort of maximise that turnover and keep people moving. And do that in an efficient way to get them back to their seat, but also having got whatever they needed to get.
And do different types of people queue differently? Is there a difference between a country and Western audience versus a football match versus older people, younger people? And does that affect then what you do?
Absolutely. So if you look at a music venue, different bands will attract different types of demographics. So if you've got a One Direction or something like that, you'll have family crowds with kids. So it's a lot more, you'll need bigger spaces for them to group, but they'll also move slowly and more gently. If you've got a more lively band, you'll get a more sort of hyped up audience and people will behave slightly differently again.
And is there a difference in age? I mean, it'd be too much for you to tell me if there was a difference in politics. The Lib Dem voters are more enthusiastic queuers than reformers or something. Is there a difference in age or demographic? Are some people better at queuing?
I think it's often for we more look at what they're queuing for. So it's more a case of how keen they are to get to the front of that queue and what the purpose of the queue is. So if it's gaining entry to a music concert or something, they'll be very keen to get to the front. Other queues, not so much.
It's so interesting, this. Tim, I was struck being at the party conferences over the last couple of weeks. In fact, this time last week, there was a lot of talk about there was an enormous queue outside the Reform conference, which was proof of how, according to their supporters, of how popular they were as a political force. Then in Liverpool this week, huge queues outside the Labour Party conference, which commentators were saying was proof that they just hadn't got enough people to process getting through the security and all of that sort of thing. We like to think we are better at it, Tim. Are other countries better at queuing?
I think it's impossible to say, you know, who's good and who's bad. I mean, what makes a good queue? We certainly lead the world, I think, in the conceit that we're good at this. And also, bizarrely, that we like doing it, which I don't think necessarily that either of those things are true. But at the point at which I was writing about this and sort of trying to disabuse people of the idea that kind of Britons were the best of all at doing this, the Queen died. Mm. And then suddenly we had miles and miles and miles of people queuing to pay their respects, in inverted commas. And indeed, in one of the most extraordinary sites, I thought, a queue to join the queue. my task has failed, I think.
We've got an example of this, of you know, and it was, again, it was a sort of the great and the good rubbing side by side with the, you know, rich man and poor man all in the queue together, including, this is David Beckham joining the queue to see the Queen lying in state. Let's take a listen.
And I think, you know, something like this today is meant to be shared together. So, you know, the fact that we've been here, we're eating Pringles, we're eating sherbet lemons, you know, we're eating sandwiches, having coffee, so donuts as well.
Adam, you didn't think that you'd be in the queue with David Beckham, did you?
No, I didn't, but big respect to him. He stood with us. And yes, he's paid his respects how he wants to. Yeah. And I think that's amazing. And I've just, it's just been really good.
And how long have you been in the queue, David?
I think we all got here, 12 hours.
Right, okay.
Paying his respects with some Pringles. Now, the one thing, the most contentious thing I need to ask you both about is queuing in pubs, because there's been a lot of talk about this. In a pub, both Tim and Brett, do you line up at the bar or do you form an orderly queue? You, first of all, Tim.
I absolutely don't form an orderly queue. That's one of the kind of great things. Is we may consider ourselves to be queuers in Britain, but the pub is the last bastion, I think. The place that we expect this to be sort of relatively disorderly, and long may that last, in my view.
What do you think, Brett?
Well, I don't form an orderly queue either, but I think that's the sort of, we have different systems of queuing that we arrange, and that's what we call a disorganised queue, i.e. there is no queue, because you'll always get more aggressive people sort of pushing to the front.
Elbows out. Does waving a... I mean, because nobody has money anymore, but from your experience, does waving a £5 note help, Brett?
You know, no.
You probably can't get much of a £5 note.
You can't get anything for five and a half.
Honestly, it's absolutely fascinating. This segment, that was Brett Little from the design company Arup, and Professor Tim Newburn, an academic who's looked at all of these things in the world of queuing, which is genuinely fascinating. I loved all this. We've had so many messages today. Lots of you getting in touch about queuing. Paul says, many years ago, my dad was driving us to the funeral of a relative. Partway there, he joined the queue of a traffic forming the funeral cortege. Unfortunately, when we arrived at the crematorium, we realised it was the wrong cortege. We were in completely the wrong place. Very nice. And this is Alex in Dorset, says, my dad and I, who were, my dad was an airline pilot, were drinking at Malaga Airport. We had a few too many and were running late. The queue to get through security was about 200 people strong, so my dad whipped out his pilot ID card and proceeded to walk past everyone in the queue, saying in a slurred voice, pilot coming through! As we proceeded, I could hear people heckling at us. Reaching the front of the queue, I said, also in a slurred voice, I'm with him. We were probably waved through, but no, he wasn't flying that day. Very nice. 850-58. 850-58 if you want to text in. Wayne in from Lincoln's been in touch saying, finally, Matt Shawley lists the telephone number correctly. 8505. I've been doing that all along. The other one I have trouble with, 08085909693. There we are. We can round things off now. It seems like a long time ago that I got my balls out. When we picked the constituency, we are looking for a listener in Christchurch. Alan's on the line. Hello, Alan.
Hi there. Yeah.
So what is your claim to Christchurch, please?
The wider constituency of Christchurch, because I don't live in Christchurch.
Nobody covers an area.
Outside, but yep. I've lived here for 21 years. So that's basically my one and only claim to fame.
Have you ever seen a celebrity in Christchurch?
No, I've been desperately tried to look up who's famous in Christchurch. The only person I could find was Jamie Redknapp, went to school in Christchurch.
So I will take that. Oh, because Harry Redknapp, he lives down around there, isn't he? On the Dorset coast.
Yeah, that's down at Sandbanks in Poole.
Sandbanks, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Where would you go if you were going for a Sunday roast this weekend? Where would you go?
There's quite pleasant. There's plenty of pleasant sort of cafes overlooking the quay
and
sit and look at the swans and keep your distance in case they attack you.
Alan, do not get attacked by a swan. We had someone attacked by a ball this week. Oh, Alan, you are the MMP for Christchurch. We'll send you a certificate and a rosette. Thank you for your message today. Thank you for listening. Okay. A slightly crazy show. Stay tuned. Drive next with Tony and Holly. I'll see you Monday. Have a good weekend.
The Voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
A very good afternoon. At 4 o'clock, here are your BBC News headlines. And the Prime Minister has paid tribute to Dame Maggie Smith, who has died aged 89, describing her as a true national treasure. In a career spanning almost 70 years, the actress won two Oscars in 1969 and 1978. She went on to win a new generation of fans as Professor McGonagall in the Harry Potter films and in Downton Abbey. Our entertainment correspondent is Colin Patterson.
When you think about her career, so much of her biggest success came so late on, because at the same time she was doing Harry Potter, there was also Downton Abbey with the Countess of Grantham. Just the way that she had those withering put-downs throughout that series, providing the laughs, the menace, and just that, the authority as the head of that household there.
A statement from Dame Maggie's sons, the actors Toby Stevens and Chris Larkin, described her as an extraordinary mother and grandmother. Two boys have been given life sentences with a minimum of 8.5 years for murdering a man with a machete. The pair, who can't be named, were just 12 years old when they attacked 19-year-old Sean Sasehay in a park in Wolverhampton last November. The judge, Mrs. Justice Tipple, spoke about the victim's character during sentencing.
Sean Sasehay had a unique personality, was a humble person who loved to help others and cared deeply about his family. His mother has described him as a brave soul who was generous and compassionate.
Elsewhere, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has praised what he's described as the incredible courage of Israeli soldiers while addressing world leaders at the UN General Assembly. Despite pressure on him to agree to a ceasefire with Hezbollah in Lebanon, Mr. Netanyahu said that Israel's offensive there would continue until his country succeeded in its objectives. Donald Trump is meeting the Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky in New York. The Republican presidential candidate